from deep inside your radio.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, what a fun old week this was, huh? It's spring, which is fun, and the Republicans have now decided that lying to Congress is a bad thing, which, you know, we were waiting for that way back in the 80s when Oliver North, yes, the very same Oliver War Stories North, was convicted of lying to Congress, if you can imagine that. His defenders were saying, well, he was freed on a technicality by appeals court, so he never served any time. But B, he was just lying to Congress. It's not like a federal case. This week, Friday, Bill Frist, Senate Majority Leader, got on the floor. Stood up on the floor of the Senate and said, we're going to declassify Richard Clark's testimony before the House-Senate Joint Intelligence Committee. Richard Clark, of course, the man of the week who made all the headlines criticizing the Bush administration's pre-9/11 terrorism preps and post-9/11 Iraq War. Just two little things he criticized. Just two little quibbles he had. And the roof fell down. Anyway, Bill Frist is on the floor of the Senate saying, we're going to declassify this testimony that Richard Clark gave under oath. And if there's any conflict between that testimony under oath and the testimony Mr. Clark gave this week before the 9/11 Commission under oath, he's guilty of lying to Congress. And said Bill Frist, that's a very serious thing. I certainly hope that somewhere in the bowels of Fox News, Ollie North is weeping today. But my bet's not on it. Hello, welcome to the show. And yes, Fox News is all bowels.
Yeah. great big onion.
I like onions. Hello from the edge of America, from the home of the homeless. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to Le Show. Can you hear the fan in the background? Yeah, he's just hanging out for an autograph. No, it's just it's very hot in here. Or is it just Rob Lowe? I don't know, but it's warm. It's springtime warmth all over the Le Show Dome. Hey, the focus of White House obloquy, if you will, if they did, this week has been, of course, on Richard Clark, for those two little quibbles he has with the Bush administration, the pre-9/11 preps and the post-9/11 war on Iraq. Those just those two little things. And so they've been a full-court press against him, as you'd think. But is anybody standing up for Richard Clark? Flint Leverett, a former CIA analyst and Middle East specialist who was on the National Security Council staff of President Bush until a year ago, says, quote, Clark's critique of administration decision-making and how it did not balance the imperative of finishing the job against al-Qaeda versus what they wanted to do in Iraq is absolutely on the money, unquote. He said that Arabic-speaking special forces officers and CIA officers who were doing a good job tracking Osama bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri, and other al-Qaeda leaders were pulled out of Afghanistan in March 2002 to begin preparing for Iraq. Quote, we took the people out who could have caught them. But even if we get bin Laden or Zawahiri now, continues Leverett, it is 2 years too late. Al-Qaeda is a very different organization now. It has had time to adapt. The administration should have finished this job, unquote. Just tells you something. If in 2 years Al-Qaeda can adapt that dramatically, and CBS has stayed the same. Jessica, well, these other people. Pat Lang, head of the Middle East and South Asia Intelligence Department of the Defense Intelligence Agency for 7 years, says when you commit as, he doesn't stutter when he says it, but he says, quote, when you commit as much time and attention and resources as we did to Iraq, which I do not believe is connected to the worldwide war against the jihadis, then you subtract what you could commit to the war on terrorism. You see that especially in the Special Forces commitment, as we have only so many of them, unquote. Today on CNN, Richard Perle says, those people just have an outdated view of the war on terrorism. You got to go after the countries that support terrorists. And so, of course, we attacked Syria. No, we didn't. We attacked Pakistan. No, we didn't. From the dog trainer, wow. The Bush administration's pre-war claims that Saddam Hussein had built that fleet of mobile chem bio weapon labs. It was based chiefly on information from a now discredited Iraqi defector codenamed Curveball. Curveball. Let's go to war because of what Curveball told us. I'm not making this up, ladies and gentlemen. I don't even think the dog trainer is making this up. U.S. officials never had direct access to the defector and didn't even know his real name. Hey, with a code name like Curveball, why do you gotta have a real name? Real name, Scroogey. Didn't even know his real name until after the war. Instead, his story was provided by German agents. His story has since crumbled under doubts raised by the Germans and the scrutiny of U.S. weapons hunters who've come to see his code name as particularly apt. U.N. weapons inspectors hypothesized that the mobile labs might exist. This is where it all began. They wrote a memo saying, well, they could have this, because they don't have that. They then asked former exile leader, here he is again, Ahmad Shalabi, a bitter enemy of Hussein, to help search for intelligence that supported the theory. Soon after, here comes a young chemical engineer in a German refugee camp, claiming he had been hired out of Baghdad University to design and build biological warfare trucks for the Iraqi army. Based largely on his account, President Bush and his aides repeatedly warned of the shadowy germ trucks dubbed Winnebagos of Death or Hell on Wheels. And they became part of Secretary of State Powell's dramatic presentation to the UN Security Council last February. With photos, Mitt photos. Only later did the CIA learn that the defector was the brother of one of Shalabi's top aides and began to suspect he might have been coached to provide false information. Congressional investigators fear the CIA may have inadvertently conjured up and then chased a phantom weapons system. David Kaye, former Bush administration chief weapons inspector in Iraq, said the case of Curveball was particularly troubling out of all the intelligence failures in Iraq. This is the one that's damning, Kaye said. This is the one that has the potential for causing the largest havoc in the sense that it really looks like a lack of due diligence and care in going forward. Kaye said the defector was absolutely at the heart of the matter of intense interest to us, but Curveball, he said, turned out to be an out-and-out fabricator. Dick Cheney, as recently as this January, after the doubts were raised already, referred to the trucks as conclusive proof that Iraq was producing weapons of mass destruction. CIA Director Tenet later told a Senate committee he called Cheney to warn him the evidence was increasingly suspect. Chalabi's Iraqi National Congress is blamed most often for lies or distortions by Iraqi opposition groups contributing to numerous misjudgments about WMD, the rival Iraqi National Accord, and various Kurdish groups also responsible for sending dubious defectors to Western intelligence. So they were all doing it. It wasn't just Shalabi. Don't point the finger at Mr. Shalabi. One focus of the ongoing investigation is whether the CIA should have known Curveball was not credible. Well, how about if his codename isn't Fastball? You put one strike against him, right there. A former U.S. official who's reviewed the classified files said the German intelligence warned the CIA last spring, that's after Colin Powell spoke, that it had various problems with the source. The German intelligence sent the warning after Powell gave his Security Council speech. You can imagine the consternation that kicked off, said the U.S. official. It suggested that what the Germans had been passing to us was false. They were backing away. Kaye, our weapons inspector until he quit, saying there were none, said Powell's account was, quote, disingenuous. Kaye added, if Powell had said to the Security Council, it's one source, we never actually talked to him, and we don't know his name, as he's describing this to the Security Council, I think people would have laughed us out of court. Powell said at the UN the two other Iraqi sources, who he said were in a position to know, had corroborated the eyewitness account. Kaye said the debriefing files on that pair showed they had never had direct contact with the biowarfare trucks. None of them claimed to have seen them. They said they were aware of the mobile program. They had heard there was a mobile program. Objection, hearsay. Another Iraqi defector, an engineer who'd worked with Curveball, according to the CIA, specifically denied they'd worked on such facilities. Powell did not cite that defector. The CIA acknowledged last month the fourth defector that Powell cited, a major in Iraq's intelligence service, had lied when he said Baghdad had built mobile research labs. The Pentagon's Defense Intelligence Agency twice debriefed that defector in early 2002, but then concluded he did not have first-hand information and was probably coached by Shalabi. The agency posted a fabrication notice on a classified computer network to warn other U.S. intelligence agencies that this defector had lied. But CIA officials said that notice, the fabrication notice, was overlooked. And his information was cited in Powell's speech, as well as in the CIA's national intelligence estimate to Congress, before Congress voted for the war. So if a fabrication notice doesn't flag it for the CIA, what would? Oh, by the way, his name is Curveball. Britain's armed, this on the subject, ladies and gentlemen, of whether having invaded Iraq and now being responsible for the aftermath. Boy, that's nice neutral language. Whether the West, i.e. the United States and the UK, are in a position, let's say Syria says, you know what? I'm not impressed. You invaded Iraq. They'd been weakened by 12 years of sanctions. The guy had no weapons. It was a paper tiger. You beat him. Big deal. I'm not impressed. I'm going forward with my little thing. Let's just hypothesize. Let's make up a world in which Syria says that. What do we do? Dateline London from the Telegraph, a conservative newspaper. Britain's armed forces will not be able to mount another operation on the scale of the Iraq War for another 5 years, according to the Chief of Defense Staff, General Sir Michael Walker, told the House of Commons Defense Committee the Army in particular would not be able to recover from operations in Iraq until 2008 or 2009. So, Syria, you got 5 clear years there, babe. I think we've already accepted we cannot do another large-scale operation now, he said. We are unlikely to be able to get to large scale much before the end of the decade. The Army has been stretched to breaking point by its involvement in the war on terrorism and a series of operational commitments in the Falklands. Excuse me. That's important work. Cyprus, Sierra Leone, Bosnia, Kosovo, Afghanistan, and Northern Ireland. The Army was still reconstituting units from the Iraq conflict and at the same time undergoing reorganization. He said if he was asked to send the same number of troops to another trouble spot urgently, he would have to tell his boss, the defense secretary, that, quote, something will have to give. Even the problems have already affected the deployment of extra troops to Afghanistan to back up the hunt for Osama bin Laden. Defense chiefs have been considering sending 1,400 commandos and paratroops to support the U.S. Special Forces operation in Afghanistan. But British troops cannot be committed to the hunt for more than 6 months. One of the two units going to Afghanistan possibly was due to be sent to Basra. So if it goes to Afghanistan, another infantry unit will have. So if I'm the head of North Korea, I'm thinking, hey, I got 5 years. I can watch all my Daffy Duck cartoons and make trouble. Meanwhile, in Baghdad, the United States will transfer power in Iraq to a prime minister. Doesn't that sound European? To a hand-picked prime minister. Well, if we're doing the hand-picking, why isn't it president? Prime minister. It's so European. We are thus abandoning plans for an expansion of the current 25-member governing council. This is according to coalition officials in Baghdad who talked to a liberal British newspaper, The Guardian. Fear of wrangling among Iraqi politicians has forced Washington to make this latest switch in strategy. It's third in 6 months. The search is now on for an Iraqi to serve as prime minister. Hey, how about Ahmad Shal? No. He will almost certainly be from the Shia Muslim majority and probably a secular technocrat, or a secular technocrat. There will be no Paul Bremer, and there will be a prime minister, a coalition official said. That will be the biggest change. The choice of prime minister has become the main. Hey, me, choose me. I'm secular, and I run the board. I mean, that's kind of technocratic. This has become the main focus of concern for the occupation authorities. Initial plans for enlarging the governing council have been downgraded in favor of letting the present members get on with their job. This latest shift in focus follows a visit by Robert Blackwell. No, not me. President Bush's special envoy in Iraq for talks with Bremer. Plans to create a three-man presidency. Now you're talking. It's presidential, and it's got the Trinity. That's American. Are still underway, but its powers would be mainly symbolic. Officials hope the man appointed will be a technocrat to avoid rivalry between competing politicians. Yeah, we wouldn't want that. That would be like what happens in a democracy. The interim government will serve until direct elections are held at the end of the year. Bets? End of the year? All right, so we're going to have a prime minister, even though it sounds very European, and we're going to pick him. That's this week's plan. On another topic, here at the top of the news, where the air is always thin. It's not exactly from outside the bubble. Well, Boston's pretty close to outside the bubble. They don't hear the show. That's how outside the bubble can you get? 49 retired generals and admirals this week urged President Bush to suspend plans for a national missile shield and use the money instead to safeguard nuclear materials abroad and ports and borders at home. But we're already... we're not. The Bush administration plans to put up that nationwide missile defense system starting in September. $3.7 billion this year for the start of the project. the 49 former senior military leaders, what do they know, ladies and gentlemen? Former senior military leaders. Excuse me? We're supposed to listen to you guys now? When Dick Pearl says this is a good idea, they say the system remains unproven. They also said it is more likely that terrorists would smuggle weapons of mass destruction into the United States than a country would launch a missile at the U.S., risking a devastating retaliatory strike. So deterrence still works, except for the guys that a missile defense won't defend you against. Aside from that, good plan. As you have said, Mr. President, our highest priority is to prevent terrorists from acquiring and employing weapons of mass destruction, wrote the former officers, including retired Admiral William Crowe, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, under Reagan. They added the militarily responsible course of action is to use the funding for the missile shield to secure the multitude of facilities containing nuclear weapons and materials and to protect our ports and borders against terrorists. The General Accounting Office, the nonpartisan investigative arm of Congress, recently concluded only two of the anti-missile system's 10 key technologies have been fully tested. To make the September deadline, the Pentagon has waived some testing requirements. Hey, why don't we try that for No Child Left Behind? I know you kids aren't reading well, but we like your school. We're waiving the testing requirements. Just because it's a nice-looking school. The military's top weapons tester stated earlier this month that further testing is not planned, quote, for the foreseeable future. Till after we deploy, I guess. But as long as we're sending the top, you know, that's weaponry, ladies and gentlemen. As long as we're sending the very best troops in the very best physical condition this just in from Washington. To meet the demand for troops in Iraq, the military has been deploying some National Guard and Army Reserve soldiers who aren't fit for combat. This is the United States military, ladies and gentlemen. More than a dozen members of the Guard and Reserves told Knight Ridder newspapers they were shipped off to battle with little attention paid to their medical histories, including ailments such as asthma, diabetes, recent surgery, and hearing loss. Shoot the plane down! What? Once in Iraq, the soldiers faced severe conditions that aggravated their medical problems, and the medical care available to them was limited. David Lloyd, a 44-year-old mechanic with the Tennessee National Guard, died of a heart attack in Iraq last August. His wife said her husband didn't know he had a problem, but his autopsy showed three blockages in his coronary arteries. He should never have been deployed, she said. He was supposed to have been given a thorough physical. He had none. The only thing he had was the shots. Well, the shots worked. They funneled us through the medical part, boom, 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 said Michael Scott, an Iowa National Guardsman who has a herniated disc. They let it be known they weren't real interested in hearing about stuff. No, you're fine right now. Sounds like the doctors worked in the draft in the 60s. A memo from the European Regional Medical Command in Germany, where many injured soldiers were sent, criticized the pre-deployment medical screening and said soldiers who were unfit for Iraq were having to be sent home. This was an added cost for the military. Michael Kilpatrick, a top Pentagon health official, acknowledged some medically unqualified troops have been sent to Iraq, but said, quote, the percentages are extremely small. And he said the Pentagon is taking steps to improve medical screening. I guess they want those numbers to be extremely smaller. Several sources said many soldiers weren't given physicals, but only were asked a few cursory questions about their health by medical screeners. I know that doctor. He works in town. Gary Mosley, a retired first sergeant with a reserve unit from Mississippi, said the practice of sending medically unqualified troops was widespread in the Guard or Reserves. It wasn't about healthy troops. It was about the number of troops. Soldiers with medical conditions that would be adversely affected by deployment were rubber-stamped as fit for duty, he says. Medical profiles were ignored. But the numbers are extremely small, ladies and gentlemen. Extremely small. And we like extremely small numbers. And finally, the Department of Energy has failed to keep accurate count of worker injuries at nuclear waste cleanup sites across the United States. Its records often downplay the dangers of cleanup work. So says a draft report by the department's own inspector general. Let's see if this report actually makes it through. This is a draft released to the Washington Post. Any bets on whether it actually gets to be published? For 9 out of 10 private contractors that perform environmental cleanup at old bomb-making sites, the audit found the Department of Energy maintained inaccurate and incomplete accident and injury data. Some of the department's safety performance statistics were overrated. That is, performance had been reported to be better than it actually was. The investigation also found instances in which major cleanup contractors were not required to report any information on how many workers were hurt or sickened while working around nuclear waste. Well, of course, if you had to report that, then there would be numbers. It found the department also fails to record a number of significant number of workplace injuries that contractors themselves have documented. The most serious example was at the Iowa lab, where the main contractor, Bechtel, reported 463 days lost to injury. The Department of Energy's database says it was 166 days. The Inspector General's investigation comes amid reports of increasing injuries to workers at Hanford, the largest and most expensive nuclear waste cleanup site in the history of the universe. This week alone, three more workers were seen for medical evaluation after smelling a sweet odor, chemical vapors from underground tanks. A sweet odor! Department of Energy spokesman says the draft audit from the Inspector General is, quote, incomplete and, quote, wrong. There shouldn't be a rush to judgment on a draft report that does not consider all sides of the issues. We believe that we have systems in place, says the spokesperson, that accurately reflect the recording of safety at our sites. It's a political season, he concludes. Yes, it is. And now, ladies and gentlemen, if you're in any doubt about which direction we should be going, this is from the White House spokesman Scott McClellan's briefing with reporters this week in the wake of Israel's targeted assassination of the head of Hamas. Was he paraplegic or quadriplegic? Anyway, he's dead. He's no plegic. And the Israelis sent a rocket and killed him. And here is the Daily White House briefing. Scott McClellan, President Bush's spokesperson, basically got one thing to say, which direction we want to go in.
Go ahead, Tom.
What does this do, from your point of view, what does this do to the peace process? Is it a setback?
Well, it's always important to keep in mind that there are possibilities for moving forward. I mentioned one important aspect, and that is that the Palestinian Authority and the Palestinian Prime Minister and Cabinet act to crack down on terrorism. That is a foundation for moving forward on the two-state vision. You also have some ideas that have been presented by Prime Minister Sharon. We've been in discussion with the government of Israel about those ideas. Those certainly have the potential to help move forward on peace in the region.
Go ahead, Tony. Do you have any words for countries or groups who maintain that nothing can be settled in the rest of the Arab world until the Israeli-Palestinian issue is settled? Are they using that as a trolling tactic?
Well, I mean, there's the greater Middle East, and there's the Israeli-Palestinian situation as well. Certainly, we are moving forward in Iraq on advancing freedom and democracy in a very volatile region, and that's an important effort that will help bring about stability in the region. But we also have remained very engaged for quite some time on the Middle East peace process. The president has been strongly committed to working with the parties to move forward on the two-state vision. There are always difficulties in this process, but we continue to call on all parties to focus on moving forward on the peace process.
But do they use it as a stalling tactic?
Does who?
The rest of the Arab world or the Palestinians?
Well, all parties have responsibility. We've made that very clear, and we've called on all parties to help move that process forward and move forward on the president's two-state vision. Mm-hmm. Suzanne?
Israel's foreign minister, after his meeting with Cheney, said this morning at the White House that this is a message to Hamas leaders that they don't have the immunity anymore. Do you think a targeted assassination is the correct way to deliver that message?
I think that where our focus is on working with the parties in the region, all parties, Palestinians, Israelis, as well as Arab countries, to move forward on the two-state vision that the president outlined. We continue to believe that the roadmap's the best way forward to get to that two-state vision. And we call on all parties during this time period to exercise restraint, to help bring about calm in the region so that we can get back to moving forward on that two-state vision.
But if I could just try and spell it out here, the administration's policy remains unchanged concerning targeted assassinations. The United States government opposes that. this was the target of assassination. So this was wrong in the view of the United States government.
Well, Terry, again, during this time period, we want to continue to urge all parties to show restraint. That's where our focus is, so that we can get back to moving forward on the peace process.
Hey, which way should we go? What do you think? I got it. Let's get back to moving forward.
Jesse James and Frank James, Billy Kidd and all the rest, supposed to be some bad cats out in the West. If those cats could have dug me and my love bandit ways, they would have hung up their guns, child, and made it to the grave. Course I'm a love bandit. Don't you know I'm a love bandit? Well now, girls near and far, when I walk into the bar, says I'm a love bandit. I used to jump on my white horse Cadillac and ride across the borderline. I'd rope 55 girls and kiss them all at the same time. I'd take 35 or 40 and I'd put them on a freight. That was a $950 million reward for me in each and every state. The sheriff say, is your name Johnny Guitar Watson? In a very deep voice, I said, yes, a brother sheriff, and that's your wife on the back of my horse. Cause I'm a love bandit. Don't you know I'm a love bandit? Well, now the people, they all know everywhere I go that I'm a love bandit.
This is Le Show, and now, time for the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Dateline Boston. In response to protests by the NAACP and other groups, Mike Barnicle. Yeah, it's not as bad as codename Curveball, but it is named Barnicle. Mike Barnicle read a 17-minute apology. Well, that's got to be the record. On his radio show yesterday, sometime this week, for using a racially and sexually charged word to describe Janet Langhart, a former news personality in Boston. Barnicle used the word Mandingo to describe Langhart, who is African-American and married to former Secretary of Defense William Cohn, who is white. Mandingos are members of a group of West African people. Mandingo is also the title of a 1975 movie in which a black male slave is paired intimately with a white female slave master. The radio station declined to provide tapes of the apology or the original comment, but Barnicle said someone in the studio asked casually during the broadcast if the pair were married. Yeah, I know them both, Bill Cohn and Janet Langhart, kind of like Mandingo, Barnicle said. Cohen was in the news because he was testifying at the 9/11 Commission. Barnicle said he had no recollection of the slavery aspect of the film. All I remember is a terrible movie, he said. Barnicle resigned his post as a Boston Globe columnist in 1998 amid questions about his sources. That's a delicate way of saying he was alleged to have plagiarized. He decided to apologize on the air because he understands how someone might think it was offensive. Mandingo. Dateline Montreal. A high school principal has apologized for the booing of the U.S. flag during an assembly last week, an event that drew reaction from as far away as Alberta. Gee, imagine that. Principal Michael Cristoforo apologized on behalf of Wagar High School's 300 students, this is in Montreal, to a U.S.-born 8th-grade student who was jeered Thursday by a handful of students protesting the war in Iraq. The apology was made at a special assembly. The booing was so intense, the girl burst into tears. An apology assembly. Dateline Providence, Rhode Island, the record company that released a cover album by the band whose pyrotechnics sparked a nightclub fire that killed 100 people, said it had no intention to exploit the tragedy. The company Comet Records, an Italian firm, said they've told rock band Great White that distribution of the album will be halted. Name of the album? Burning House of Love. We at Comet are deeply sorry that our choice of title has disappointed band members, fans, and buyers of the record in general, the company said. A Great White manager, they have more than one apparently, said the CD was an unauthorized release. Comet said a producer picked the album title without thinking about any connection to the fire. Why would you think Burning House of Love has any connection to a nightclub fire? Dateline Japan, Mitsubishi Fuso Truck and Bus Company says it will recall about 112,000 large vehicles due to defective wheel hubs that have caused a series of accidents. The truck and bus maker officially apologized for taking so long to recognize the design flaw, which causes wheels to detach from the vehicles. Minor little item. They are sold as wheeled vehicles. An accident 2 years ago left a Yokohama woman dead. We deeply regret the long time of 2 years it took after that fatal accident to file the recall and wish to apologize for having caused public disturbance, said President Wilfred Porth. I wish to visit the family of the victim of the accident and extend my condolences, and in fact he did. He placed flowers and bowed deeply at the grave. Diminutive workout guru Richard Simmons allegedly smacked a 255-pound man who made fun of Simmons' exercise videos. He was arrested and cited for misdemeanor assault. This is, I believe, somewhere in Arizona. Anyway, he was posing for photos and signing autographs, yes, while walking through the concourse at Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport. By the way, his real first name, Milton. Then he was spotted by a man, according to police report. The man said, "Hey, everybody, it's Richard Simmons. Let's drop our bags and rock to the 50s. Simmons told cops he took offense and had to, quote, bitch slap, unquote, the man, according to a Phoenix police sergeant. The alleged victim, 23-year-old Chris Farney, claims Simmons' bitch slap came with the warning, quote, it's not nice to make fun of people with issues. Farney is a 6-foot-1-inch-tall Harley-Davidson salesman and cage wrestler. What do you want to be when you grow up, Chris?
I think I want to be a cage wrestler.
Okay, then take lots of math. He was not injured, but he wants to press charges against the 5'7", 155-pound Simmons, despite receiving a personal apology from Simmons. So Richard has apologized. The St. Paul City Council apologized to the city's American Indians on Wednesday, acknowledging it did a poor job of letting them know about opportunities to join the police chief selection committee. The council has been criticized for failing to assemble a more diverse panel. The group is made up of 11 whites, 3 blacks, 1 Asian, and 1 Latino. A Hispanic member was added late in the process to broaden the representation. Said David Glass, an Ojibwe, "The apology is nice, but how many times over hundreds of years can you listen to, 'I'm sorry we messed up'? If they were sincere in their apologies, the next step would be to fix it. Give the first people a seat at the table. That isn't likely to happen, according to council staff members, because no Indians applied." Well, what about amending? Sorry. And choking back tears, former Hartford State Legislator, Hartford, Connecticut State Legislator Barnaby Horton told a Superior Court judge this week he was sorry for misleading elderly voters into casting absentee ballots for him 2 years ago. "I apologize to the elderly residents who put their faith in me, and I let them down." This is a hearing whether he should be granted accelerated rehab for the voting fraud charges against him. He didn't deny the charges. He was arrested on 7 felony counts of unlawful possessions of another's absentee ballot and 3 counts as being present as a candidate when absentee ballots were completed. He's also... This was reported to the State Elections Enforcement Commission. Horton had gone from room to room at the home for low-income elderly and handicapped residents, providing them with ballots and, in some cases, encouraging them to check his name on the ballot. Said his father of the request for accelerated rehab, "I greatly fear it could crush his spirit if the request is not granted." That's a dad. That is a loyal dad. "If I violated the law, I had no intention of doing so," said former Hartford State Legislator Barnaby Horton. "If I violated the law. If. said a former state legislator, of the law that forbids you from taking other people's ballots and completing them. I'm sorry to the people of Connecticut who I represented. Whom, Barnaby, whom? And, of course, the apology that made all the headlines, even though he never said I'm sorry, he never said the words I'm sorry, Richard Clark, referred to by, more in derision than in familiarity as Dick by a lot of the critics, who began his testimony at the 9/11 Commission by telling the families of 9/11 victims, many of whom were in attendance at the commission hearing, that he had failed them, the government had failed them, and he hoped after all the facts were in that they could understand and forgive him. Didn't say, I apologize or I'm sorry, but said that, and was derided for grandstanding, and was applauded by some of the families for being the first government official to say, hey, it's on me. As noted before, the Bush administration launched a full court press, sending out all of the top officials, some of whom did testify at the 9/11 Commission, although notably Condoleezza Rice still refuses to, claiming executive privilege. She did testify in private. I'm not sure whether that was under oath, but she will not testify under oath in public, though she will go on every television program, but that doesn't violate executive privilege. She's on 60 Minutes this weekend. And as I say, all the other officials went out and basically criticized Clark for being in the book-selling business and digging up prior statements by Clark, prior contradictory statements, when he was in the employ of the administration. Clark's explanation, of course, I was in the employ of the administration. But it's a serious business, Clark's charge, that the Bush administration was asleep at the switch on the subject of terrorism, paying more attention to other topics, missile defense, China, Iraq, and it's triggered a lot of response and maybe even a phone call.
Lethal Eagle.
Hey, like that code name. In honor of the anniversary of the war?
I think it's in honor of the way I killed at the correspondence dinner. Did you see any of the footage, 41?
Saw a little on C-SPAN.
Uh-huh.
Cute little slideshow type skit you did there. Made the Dems get their panties in a little bit of a twist.
You know, we rehearsed that thing for a solid week.
Yeah. Looked very polished.
We played rehearsal tapes for Dennis Miller's audience a couple nights, and then we focus grouped them up to Wazoo.
Not literally.
I'm not in a need-to-know position regarding that 4-1, but, you know, that enabled me to hone my deliverance.
Hey, look, if the Dems are attacking you for tasteless jokes...
Yeah, like I'm Howard Sternberg or something.
Then they're not attacking you about Dick Clark's charges.
Yeah.
You're ahead of the game.
Yeah.
Probably should find some other tasteless jokes to do next week. Yeah, maybe... Maybe do a slideshow at halftime of the NCAA championship game where you're looking for Janet Jackson's breast.
I don't think so, 41. I think you'd best leave the humor to the professionals. But look, about our friend Mr. Clark.
Yeah.
How do you and Mom think the whole thing is playing?
Yeah, you know your mom.
Yeah.
She just wants anybody who impedes her son to be spanked till he tosses his cookies.
Why would she want me to toss...
Till the guy who impedes her son tosses his cookies.
Got it. Up to speed. Mm. But how about you, 41?
Think Lee Atwater would be proud of this little campaign.
Yeah, the pre-deathbed Lee Atwater?
Yeah, the pre-apology Lee Atwater.
Yeah.
Deathbed Lee would... I think this was a little harsh.
Harsh? Hey, look, 41, you know darn well what he was trying to do to me. If you're saying I was inattentive to terrorism, if you're saying that Bill Clinton, the man on whose account we had to replace all the plumbing fixtures in the Oval Office, was tougher than I am, you're trying to wimpify me.
Know that you think that was a big issue for me.
Don't think it. Think I know it. Sir, you won a war, and they wimpified you. Wasn't going to happen to me on my watch. Just wasn't. No can-do Bob. We had no choice but to go nuclear on him.
Made it look like you were on the defensive, though, didn't it?
Just the opposite, sir. Just a complete 360. We were in total comprehensive attack modus. How can you be on the defensive when you're on the offensive? That'd be like intercepting your own pass, isn't it?
Suppose.
Yeah.
Still, you're going to end up having to let Condi Rice testify.
Oh, hey, we let Rumsfeld testify. Colin was a good witness.
Colin's a good witness,
yeah.
But if you let her go on Larry King, but not under oath in a public hearing, looks like you got something to hide.
Well,
even if you don't,
yeah.
We can ask Mr. Hussein what that can lead to.
41, I react to that remark with severe resentmentification.
Yeah.
There's just nothing in common between George W. Bush and Saddam Hussein. You know, just for starters, as you well know, we do have weapons of mass destruction. But
look, Sprout, whether you know it or not, your guys are already working on a face-saving way for Condi to testify in the open. If it isn't on your desk now, it will be by Monday.
Well, C-41, I don't mean to suggest that by suggesting I'm out of the loop, you yourself are out of the loop.
Never been out of the loop, son. Even when I was.
But we're moving the ball way up the field on this Dick Clark thing this week.
You are?
Yes, sir. In the affirmatory. Phase one of Operation Cut the Legs Off the Sucker was digging up every piece of verbiage he delivered while he was working for us and setting that up against what he's saying now when he's just trying to sell a book.
The whole Dick Clark versus Dick Clark deal.
Yes, sir. Exactamatissimo. Well, I got a fella sitting in the Oval with me right now. Gonna make that case even more compellulous. Hold on, 41.
Well, hello, Mr. President.
Hey, who's this? Voice sounds familiar.
Dick Clark, sir.
From the blooper show?
And Bandstand and Pyramid and whatever. Yes, sir, how are you?
Well, can't complain.
Mm-hmm.
Golf game's going in the toity, but what are you doing in the executive mansion there, my friend?
Tell you a funny story. I was in Burbank taping the wraparounds for the commentary track of the Bloopers DVD when I got a call. Would I like to come to our nation's capital and support our commander-in-chief when he's taking friendly fire? Well, sir, long story short, we wrapped the session early. I ate the lunch penalty. Car picks me up half an hour later. Before I know it, I'm riding American First Class, which, as you may know, sir, is not all that the civilians might think it is. And the next thing you know, I'm here in the White House basement taping some of my own opinions about this administration's response to the war on terror.
That was the short answer. I hate to hear the long one. Well, so they're just going to put ads with you on the air?
Dick Clark versus Dick Clark. Which one do you believe? You see, Mr. President, they made a heck of a case that all the equity I'd built up with the public over the years of doing not just the shows, but the commercials for the light rock radio stations all across the country. In their test, 90% of the focus groups believe what I like to call the real Dick Clark.
Without the E. What'd he say?
The one without the E. Hey, nice talking to you, Mr. President.
Yeah.
I'm sure you're busy. I know I am.
Take care. $10 million ad buy. By the end of next week, our little friend, the other Mr. Clark, going to be selling his books out of the trunk of his car. And we can go back to pounding his carriness on looking French.
Pretty neat, 43. Have to admit it. Even the deathbed Lee Atwater would like it.
Yeah. Hey, speaking of France, final question for you, 41. They got me going over to Paris for the 40th anniversary of the D-Day, meeting with the French president and all.
Yeah.
Doesn't that wimpify me, you know, me, go to France?
Well,
shouldn't he be coming here?
Yeah. No, not for the D-Day thing.
Shorter distance for our veterans to travel.
Well,
see, I really do care about our veterans.
Think you just gotta go to France. You know, I have to do it sometime in your life.
Yeah. I'll tell you one thing, though.
Hmm?
I'm not eating any of their damn snail's legs.
Okay, there you go. Stand on principle. Look, 43, you take care of yourself.
Yeah, tell Mom thanks about the cookies.
Will do.
got me a hat and an old guitar, and I made it up payment on the second-handed car. Got me a job on the radio, saving up money for a fiddle and a bow to do the radio boogie. All over the dial, with the sun and cake, with the red-eyed lick, it's Tennessee style. Just grind it in the barn.
Do the radio boogie
all over the dial, with a solid kick and a red-eyed lick, and it's Tennessee style. By the radio,
we'll do the radio boogie
all over the dial. Sonic kick and red eye lick, it's Tennessee
say. We do the radio boogie
all over the dial, with a solid kick and a red-eyed lick, it's Tennessee style.
The radio boogie
all over the dial, with a solid kick and a red-eyed lick, it's Tennessee
style. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a war unlike any other, and it'll go on for years. But we can notch one victory this week in the war on error. In the wake of September 11th, Condi Rice said, "Nobody ever imagined that terrorists would think of using planes as weapons." And certain broadcasts heard on this frequency at this time slot said, "Well, aren't those people paid to imagine stuff?" And this week, in fact, Condi Rice, in the face of testimony that there were intelligence reports going back into the 90s speculating on the use of aircraft as weapons by terrorists, said she, quote, misspoke. She misspoke. Ladies and gentlemen, nothing more need be missaid. That's going to put the cap on this edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide, throughout Europe on the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America on the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet 7.415 megahertz, around the world via the internet on your computer at two different locations, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, and available as a free download at audible.com/LeShow. Same place you get the talking books. I hope that's all they do is talk. Anyway, it would be just like another victory in the war on error if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. Uh-huh. The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. A tip of the Le Show chapeau to the San Diego and Pittsburgh desks once again. And Le Show playlists, usually available at the newly refurbished harryshearer.com. Kind of modern furbishing. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.